And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and we're happy to welcome Greg Iles back to the program today. Greg is, of course, one of the biggest thriller writers in America, having written 18 books which routinely hit the bestsellers list. We last spoke with Greg about the first installment of his Natchez Burning trilogy about Mayor Penn Cage fighting against a Klan splinter group called the Double Eagles. We missed chatting with him about the second part, The Bone Tree, but he stopped back by to chat about wrapping it up with book three, which is called Mississippi Blood. Now, Greg, what was it like when you sent in your last revisions for Mississippi Blood, knowing that this epic trilogy was coming to an end?
It was 8 years in coming. It was quite a load off my shoulders, but interestingly, when my agent saw it, I have two agents, and when one of my agents saw it, he called me back. He told me how much he loved it, but he said that he wasn't sure I had gotten where I was trying to get. And I don't usually listen to any input on my books, but with something this big, you really have to think about it. And I trust him. And he said, I'm not making any suggestions. I don't know what I mean, but just think about it. I went to sleep, and 12 hours later, I threw out the last 150 pages and rewrote the whole ending. So I don't know what to say about that, except that writing this trilogy has been different from everything I've ever done.
And it's around 2,300 pages total.
Yeah.
I'm guessing over 700,000 words.
Yeah, even just the first book's 280,000. I don't want to scare anybody.
So we're probably talking close to 750,000 words on that. Did you ever imagine when the idea first hit you that it's going to take that much space?
Not even close. You know, initially, I think you know, Stephen, I tried to write it as a single novel before I had my accident, and I knew it was coming up short. Not that it was bad, but I was pulling punches when it came to race and family in the South. And after my wreck, I knew I couldn't do that. I mean, I guess I was 51 years old when that happened. And you start to realize you don't have that long to make whatever your statement is. And you just think, all right, I'm just going to throw commercial interest to the wind and do it like I think it needs to be done.
It's almost like a Southern version of Proust in Search of Lost Time
with
gunplay.
That's right, with gunplay and bodies. Yeah, I do make concessions to the genre.
Now, the first two books take place over pretty much the course of 6 days.
A lot of people don't notice that.
There's a little bit of flashback. And then the new book is mostly a courtroom case that takes place over about a week. How do you keep stories so compact when it comes to time-wise?
Well, I would argue I didn't keep it very compact when you consider the page count. What we got, I think, the anomaly that made it come out that way is it's told in a very granular way. My old freelance editor and I call it that, a granular style of writing, in that it's many times it's second by second. You know, people see books like this and they imagine it's some James Michener thing that begins, you know, on an Indian mound outside of Natchez. No, it's second by second, minute by minute. That's how it winds up that way.
Quite a few important characters didn't survive the Bone Tree, and we don't want to ruin it for folks who haven't read the whole trilogy yet, so we'll look at some of the characters who have made it through. Not all of them, some of them, so we don't want to tip the hand on everybody.
Can I interject one thing?
Sure thing.
You bring up a point. I'll tell you what, with the Bone Tree, I learned a lesson that I didn't know even after, I guess at that point, 14 books, which was people really get invested in these characters, and when certain characters die, boy, people let you know. I got hundreds and hundreds of emails, particularly from women, after the Bone Tree. Angry, angry letters, you know? And it's a shock because from the inside as the writer, yeah, you know what you base these characters on, and they're real to an extent. But when I put myself in the position of a watcher, like with some of my favorite series or novels, I guess I do the same thing. But somehow as the god of the universe of the book, You lose sight of that when you kill a character. You
know? And there's just no pity in your heart for them at
all?
Well,
you feel it, certainly, but you also, you're obligated to feel the demands of the story. And we all know in real life, we have no control and we lose people that we love. And certainly, if you're going to depict people battling evil in any real sense, there's always a terrible price to pay for that.
Did you have an outline going in, or are you just following the story as it goes so it even surprises you when someone gets taken off the board?
You have to have an outline with something this big, but things like that, for example, the person I think we know we're talking about in the second book who died, when I began on the first page of Bone Tree, that wasn't my intent, and it just arrived there because this person began to take more chances than I had envisioned, that kind of thing.
Now, with the new book being so much a courtroom thriller, as opposed to an out-in-the-field shooting-at-each-other thriller. Is there a difference in plotting when it comes to plotting action versus courtroom procedure?
Action's a lot easier. Either way, you're talking about drama and conflict, really. Now, a trial is compacted drama in real life. That's a nice thing. But I would say the legal thriller market has been very saturated ever since Grisham broke on the scene in 93. You know, prior to that, you had Anatomy of a Murder in the 50s and the Caine Mutiny and Presumed Innocent in the 80s, but it was pretty sparse. And then all of a sudden, there were, you know, 100 lawyers making a living writing thrillers. And so people are quite accustomed to courtroom scenes, and it's easy for them to become very boring, very just trite. And so that's a challenge. And particularly since I'm not an attorney, it took a lot of work to create scenes that I thought would hold people on the edge of their seat.
In action scenes, it seems almost you can kind of plan out for these kind of counter punches in a tactical sense.
You're right.
But with a trial being more strategic, there seem to be bigger shocks that come along when someone walks in the door as the next witness.
Well, the way you point that out, you're right. Here's the thing. The tactical part of a trial is really the sleight of hand you use to hide those larger strategic surprises, I think. You know, you let people think it's going one way on the tactical level, and then you hit them with the, you know, strategic surprise.
Now, the trial we're talking about is for Dr. Tom Cage. That's Penn Cage's father. And it's been a while since Penn has practiced law, so what help can he give his father in this trial?
Well, I think he'd like to be defending his father and running the defense. As you know, having read the book, the legendary civil rights lawyer who's handling the trial seems to have lost his mind and seems to not really be defending Dr. Cage. It's very tough for a lawyer to watch another lawyer, you know, do the job they'd like to do. Just like it's, you know, my father was a doctor like Tom Cage. It's hard for a doctor to submit anybody in his family to the treatment of another doctor. That's a tough position to be in. So Penn could offer a lot of help, but he's very limited.
And one of the things that Quentin Avery has done is not request discovery to see what kind of evidence they already have on the prosecutorial side.
That was a great thing that a buddy of mine who's a prosecutor in Mississippi told me about that rule. He said nobody ever does it, but you have the option to do that. And by not requesting discovery, by not asking to see the prosecution's hand, you can keep your hand to yourself. And I thought that's such a great poker tactic. A guy like Quentin Avery might have the courage to try it.
Now, Quentin Avery is a legendary civil rights lawyer, but he also has a complication in his personality that he's lost his legs due to diabetes. And so Penn starts to wonder if that could be playing into
absolutely.
All this.
And Quentin is such a slice of real life. You know, yesterday, Jackson, Mississippi, which is 103 miles from my home, was declared the fattest city in America and number one in diabetes in America. I mean, you know, I have a prosthetic leg from my accident. You'd think Little Mississippi doesn't have a big prosthetic lab. They have more amputated limbs in Mississippi than anywhere in the country because
wow.
of diabetes. So the Quentin Avery character, people should just picture Morgan Freeman in a wheelchair. I'll say it. I pictured Morgan when I was writing that role. I just love that character. You know, he's not all good, but he is a genius.
Do you usually have a real-life person in mind when you're sketching out each character?
I don't usually, but sometimes in a book, especially a book with this many characters, it helps to have a sort of shorthand people can use, you know.
A person we don't see as much in this book, but he is here and here from time to time, is the FBI man John Kaiser, who has been instrumental in keeping Penn out of jail during this entire process.
I like that character. You know, he comes from another book, which I really love doing, Blood Memory. And two characters from that book appear in this book. I want to mention that. I do something that I like to see in other writers. I never just wanted to do a straight series, but in this universe of New Orleans, Natchez, other communities, Faraday, Louisiana, around there, I like to bring in more peripheral characters from different books so that the whole universe is sort of tied together, even though they're not just straight-on sequels. That's a lot of fun for me and I think readers, too.
We had another Mississippi writer in recently, Michael Ferris Smith.
Oh, yeah.
And his book was set in Macomb, Mississippi, down by the Louisiana border on the south. But your Natchez is bordering Faraday, Louisiana, on the river. And we were talking about just the weirdness that is in border towns.
Yeah, and Macomb, you know, I don't want to be too negative. I used to play music in Macomb and stuff. But Macomb and that area between Natchez and Macomb was particularly bad during the civil rights era. They had a heavy KKK presence there. And there's a famous story of a family called the Hefners where the daughter had been a Miss Mississippi. They were actually run out of Macomb, Mississippi for having civil rights workers just over to their house for dinner. And let me tell you, in that era, having a Miss Mississippi in your family, like that's like having the Queen in your family. And that still provided no immunity from that kind of reaction.
So what has been the reaction since Natchez Burning has come out?
In general, it's positive. It's brought a lot of tourism to Natchez. People appreciate that. On the other hand, you know, as a reviewer said, I pay Natchez the backhanded compliment of setting my novels there. But in general, I think people are ready to deal with it. And I want to make mention of a book called Devil's Walking, which is by the reporter who inspired the Henry Sexton character in Natchez Burning. It's a guy named Stanley Nelson, and he's just come out with a book about the real-life cold cases that inspired this trilogy. Between Stanley and me, I think we've sort of converted the locals and made them see this is something we have to deal with. That idea of why are you dragging up these old murders, when you put enough of a human face on it, people start to say, hey, if that was somebody in my family, I'd want the truth to come out.
Mr. Nelson and Jerry Mitchell down in Jackson are doing a great job with that.
Yes, yes.
The trial that Dr. Cage is up on is for his involvement in the death of Viola Turner, who was his nurse back in the 60s.
This is what makes it a human story. Anybody out there who's thinking about 2,000 pages, and I can't read that, you got to think about it this way. One critic said, I mean, two things that have been said are William Faulkner for the Breaking Bad generation, and one said, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus that no son should ever know. You know, on the basic level, it's about a beloved white doctor. Every little town has that. He's almost a saint in the community. But then when he's in his 70s and his son is the mayor of the town, the son learns the father may not have been the saint everyone believed he was. And he learns he has a half African-American brother, and the black nurse from the 60s comes back to town to die, as frequently happens in real life, and we end up with a murder trial. So it's a very personal story that anybody from the South, and particularly anybody who grew up on the Mississippi River, can relate to.
And I was just thinking this morning about Viola Turner's name, and that it's almost appropriate in that the viola is second fiddle to the violin in most string arrangements, and she had to play second fiddle to Peggy
Cage. I never thought
of
that. That's good. That's a really good analogy there. I learned something today.
Well, and also I was thinking about John Kaiser's name, Kaiser being Caesar, and how the Mississippi, I guess, is his Rubicon when he goes over to
Faraday. There you go. That's all good. See, that's the kind of thing where it's unintended resonance, but it's nice to when somebody sees it, you know.
And one of the characters that's been difficult to like, we can empathize with him a lot, is Lincoln Turner, who is Viola's son.
Yeah, you know, Lincoln, for me, I wish I could have spent more time with him in the books, but I couldn't do it because he really knew the inner knot of the mystery. And as a writer, as a technician, you can't go into the minds of characters who really know the innermost part of the mystery, you know. I did it with Tom a little, and that's dangerous to do. So Lincoln, here's what Lincoln is to me. He is a dark reflection of Penn, no pun intended. Penn is, you know, the son of this beloved physician. He had all the advantages, really. He went to a private school, became an attorney, going to a reputable law school, had a stellar career. Lincoln, his half-brother, the child of the mistress, who's African-American, grows up in Chicago, raised by a stepfather who's very unpleasant, barely gets into night law school, becomes sort of an ambulance chaser, falls afoul of the law. And you really start, if you look closely, it raises that question of, is birth destiny really? Is race destiny? You know, it starts to point out the inequalities that are just present in what color you're born, where you're born, what economic stratum you're born in. And I think Penn and Tom, that's one of the awakenings for them as they go through this. They want to be mad. They want to stay isolated in their family, but they realize, hey, this is part of us. You know, Tom did this, and we got to face it.
And without giving away what's kind of central to the mystery, we did learn a lot more about his upbringing in Chicago and the rot that was kind of set in by his stepfather, Junius Jelks.
I love that character, too. When he comes on the stand from prison, he's sort of like cold water thrown in everybody's face. There's the harsh truth. And I don't know that much about Chicago, but I did go a couple of times, and I got to talk to some people who grew up in those circumstances. Not much I can say about that except as close as black and white live in the South, in Mississippi, in Memphis, Alabama, Georgia. You know, it's in one way the communities are intimately tied together. There's a lot more contact than there is in the North. But in other ways, the races are completely ignorant of each other about many things just in daily life, you know.
On our side of evil is Snake Knox, and he's one of the few double eagles that's still in play in this book. And back in the 80s, there was this heavy metal song by a band called Overkill called Evil Never Dies. I start to feel that way about Snake sometimes.
Yeah. Well, the Knoxes, I don't want to say too much about where they came from, but they are largely based on a family. And the reporter I mentioned, Stanley Nelson, uncovered the terrible deeds of a group called the Silver Dollar Group in Faraday. They were an ultra-violent splinter cell of the Klan. They didn't wear hoods. They didn't go to meetings. They knew the Klan had been infiltrated by the FBI, so they broke off on their own. Their only identification was each carried a silver dollar minted in the year of his birth. They killed a lot of people. They hurt a lot of people, and not one of them went to jail for 40 years. And to this day, I think only one has been punished. The rest are dead now. So the Knoxes are certainly emblematic and inspired by those guys. And while they seem especially or uniquely evil, they're really not. They represent Southern guys who are military veterans for whom violence was not a big step, a big reach. It was their natural reaction when they needed to do something. They just did it. If they wanted to stop the progress of civil rights, they were ready to kill some people. It wasn't a big deal.
There is a strange parallel between Snake and Tom Cage in that they continue to put themselves in peril for whatever their sense of right is, but it would just be easier if either one of them just ran away.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Snake could certainly just go live in, you know, Switzerland or somewhere with the profits of his drugs and things like that. And Tom represents that guy. I think the key passage in the whole trilogy is we find out what happened to Tom in Korea, both bad and good. Because throughout the book, Tom behaves in a seemingly illogical way. He doesn't act always on self-survival, as most of us do when we're threatened. You wonder, is he crazy? Does he have Alzheimer's? Is he self-destructive? But then when you see what he did in combat in Korea, you realize this is not a normal person. A kind of person who can do one of the supposedly bad things he did, or who can show the heroism he did and the disregard for his own safety. That's the kind of guy who in peacetime can go that extra mile and show courage almost none of us could, really.
Well, and we saw it in previous books what they had to do, him and Walt Garrity,
in order
to keep on the run.
Yes, that's right.
Snake also has his own illegitimate son, as opposed to Billy Knox, who wants to be a little bit more legit. Like Penn wants to be a little bit more legit. And is it Elwha? Is
that my editor name? And I still not even sure how we say that. He's named after the father of Adolf Hitler, actually, for attentive readers.
Eloy?
Uh-huh.
Is that how they pronounce it over there?
Not sure.
And he's more than willing to get his hands dirty to prove himself to his dad.
Yeah, he's a little... I don't like doing stereotypical characters, but I've known guys like that. I laid sewer pipe with summer jobs and did things like that. And that blonde-haired Hitler youth-looking redneck, I've known quite a few guys like that.
A little beet red in the summertime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. But, you know, quick to anger and yet cold. This may not be politically correct, but one thing I pointed out in an earlier book is that when you live in the South, you do notice differences psychologically, I think, behaviorally, between the races. And one of the things that I noticed in crimes is that a lot of times in African-American crime, you tend to get crimes of passion, quick anger, quick to cool, etc. But with some of these white guys on the lower end of the economic spectrum, what you get is that slow-burning, grudge-holding hate that can last 20 years, and then they blow up and kill somebody. You know, it's a different thing, and it may not be statistically valid, but I've noticed it.
And it's funny how those people who claim to be part of the master race have so little to recommend them personally.
Oh, I'm not even going there, but yes, absolutely.
Now we have a new dynamic character that comes in Mississippi Blood, and that's the writer Serenity Butler. And she seems to be a better writer than Penn and probably tougher in a firefight as well.
That's right. She almost overshadowed Penn, and she appeared very quickly. And I never had planned for Serenity to appear, but once the thing that we can't talk about, the event that shall not be named, happened in the Bone Tree, You know, Penn has always been more of an observer than a Jack Reacher type character. He's a cerebral character. He's had to, you know, kill people, but that's not his basic nature. And so he needs a partner who's more confrontational. And Serenity, for those who don't know, she's a African-American writer who wrote a memoir that won the National Book Award. She's fairly young, but she also served in the military in Iraq. And I was doing a radio show 2 days ago, and the producer was a little slight African-American girl, and the host told me, yeah, Serenity Butler's just like my producer. She served in the military. And I said, really? And she like held up her muscles. I was like, well, the Serenity type is more common than I think, you know?
And since Penn's mother Peggy is under the same roof, whenever some sparks start to fly between Serenity and Penn, it makes things really complicated because of that echo back to Dr. Cage and Viola.
Yes, exactly. And I hope I didn't play that too heavily, but I think it's wise of Serenity. There are a few sparks between Serenity and Penn, and it's wise of her to recognize that they're walking right in the footsteps of, well, Lincoln's mother and Penn's father. And of course, in Serenity's own life, her mother was in a mixed relationship. And so, you know, like, I've been there 1,000 times in my novels, what Faulkner said, the past is never dead, it's not even past. And I think everybody listening realizes in their own life, you may even hate the way your parents made decisions, and you get into your 30s or 40s and you realize, oh my God, I'm becoming my father, I'm becoming my mother. We all do it.
So what's the most recent thing you've discovered you've fallen on your father's
I
footsteps?
Will not comment on that. no comment.
Also, there's a nice parallel between Serenity and Lincoln Turner in that they were both biracial kids,
yes.
Didn't have their fathers around either, and shows how differently their lives could turn out.
Well, that's right. And you know what? It helped bring some subtlety to this because people tend to think monolithically about white and black dealings. Now, a lot of parts of the country where you have multiracial societies, you have a lot of Asians, you have a lot of Latinos. In the South, we really still have a polarized black-white situation. And people tend to think of that monolithically, white versus black. But I ran the communications of our new black mayor in Natchez, who just won with 90% of the vote in a city that's 50% black-white. And what I'm noticing is the biggest challenges he faces are from within the black community. Okay, so the black community is not monolithic. And what you see with Serenity and Lincoln, on one hand, on a personal level, they can identify very much. And Penn is angry when she goes to Lincoln, you know, to hear his story. But by the same token, she can come back and say, there's something wrong in that story he's lying. You know, I sympathize with him, but he's lying. So it's nice to show that the subtleties and complexities go all through both races.
Now, in our current national political climate, there's a quote from Quentin Avery during the trial that really stands out. He's talking to a man who's originally from South Asia, and he says, I often find that immigrants make the most dutiful citizens.
Yeah, absolutely. Converts are always more, sometimes they're zealots, but certainly in that case, I made a resolution on this tour not to get into politics too much, but let me just say this. As an amateur historian, but pretty well read, and having been born in Germany and had very educated parents, I know a lot about Germany in the 1930s. I know a lot about the Soviet Union in 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And I know a lot about America in the 1950s. And if you have that kind of knowledge, none of what we've witnessed in the last 2 years is strange or surprising. It is very disturbing. And I hope we cure ourselves of this virus pretty quickly.
Now, while you said you weren't going to get into it on tour, in general, you don't shy away from it.
No.
And you were a group of writers who asked that the state of Mississippi remove the battle flag from the Mississippi state flag.
That's right. When the South Carolina controversy happened, and I say this as a descendant of a Louisiana cavalryman, Confederate soldier, and a South Carolina infantryman, I talked to John Grisham, and he and I organized a lot of notable Mississippians, mostly writers, but also Archie Manning, the SEC coaches, Morgan Freeman. Really a stellar group of people who all stood up and said, let's have a flag for all Mississippians. And last night in Oxford, I played a song called Mississippi, Don't You Reckon It's Time by Steve Earle that he wrote for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I'm sure a lot of people hear this and go, oh, he's just another liberal or whatever. But, you know, when you live in a state where a huge number of people will still make the absurd argument that the Civil War was not fought over slavery, And all you have to do to go is go to Jackson and check the Articles of Secession that state Mississippi seceded and fought over slavery, which they call the greatest institution ever devised by man. It's not even an argument. So you have to stand up for sanity when you live in a state. I mean, I'm proud of Mississippi. I love Mississippi, but it's time for a little reason to break in.
And considering what they were in part of Confederacy for all of, 4 years?
Yeah.
Is that what the one thing you want to judge your state by?
A lot of people, yes, is the answer for that.
With you performing on Thacker Mountain Radio last night, how often do you get back up on stage and play music?
Well, not too often. I may do it more now, but you know I play in a band with other writers for charity. Some are mildly known, like Stephen King, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Dave Barry, thank God. It's a lot of fun, and we do it for children's literacy. We were going to retire when our founder passed away not too long ago, but I saw the other day we're circulating an email. We're going to be playing in Sun Valley, Idaho. So I guess old rockers never die like they should. We just keep going.
In the books recently, Penn was putting together a house for he's getting ready to get married and have this new house that they could live into. It's called Edelweiss.
Mm-hmm.
And you yourself have a place called Edelweiss.
I do. That's the real house, my house. I bought it to be an office, and my wife's here with me. What year was it built? 1883 by Natchez Alderman. He built on land that I don't think it was legal to build on, and I took on that house after Katrina. You know, there were some tax credits, and I tell you what, if I had known what it would cost, I never would have done that. But now it's just a showpiece for the city. Anybody who comes to Natchez comes to the Bluff, just like Memphis. You know, we're both the Bluff City. I encourage people to, you know, walk up on my porch and watch the sun go down. That's fine. We will just, if you see a light, don't knock because I may be working.
Well, and there's a opportunity for people to stay there, isn't there?
Yeah. You know what happened with my accident and losing my leg? The house is three stories and it overlooks, you know, all of Louisiana and the river. But with all those stairs, I can't negotiate it too well. So I had to really cut back the amount of work I do there. And so normally, I used to let people in publishing, other writers would come through, I'd let them stay there just, you know, for free. But we thought it's sitting empty so often, so we made it a guest house, and we had our first guests this week, and so now people can rent it. It's the best place to see Natchez from.
So it's almost like a B&B.
Yeah, it almost is. It's really, technically, it's not a B&B. It's a guest house, but the great thing is it's walking distance from everything in downtown Natchez and all the landmarks from my novels, which a lot of people come to see now.
Was it edelweissnatchez.com?
No, I just go to gregisles.com, and you can see a little sub-page there.
So are you going to give Penn Cage a deserved rest?
Yes, I am. Thank God. Everybody asks. There's one more Penn book to come, but it will not be the next. Right now, the next book I'm writing is set in Oxford at Ole Miss. It's less than half the length of these books. I wouldn't say it's a fun book, but it's going to be fun for me, and it's a little bit of return to form. It's like, you remember Double Indemnity and those kind of films? This is more of a Mississippi film noir on the page, and I think it'll be fun for everybody, and being real, and there is a Memphis angle in that, too. I just remembered where we are. I should mention that.
Another parallel between Memphis and Natchez. We gave up in the Civil War pretty quick.
Did you? I don't know the history of Memphis.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot of fighting going on here.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's always been a prejudice in Mississippi. The people of Vicksburg hate us because Natchez surrendered very early, and all our houses stayed intact, and people kept a lot. And in Vicksburg, you know, they were under siege living on rats. They hate us.
Now, did the Pirates of the Mississippi get down to the Natchez area?
Yes,
did they operate down that
Certainly.
Way?
Certainly. In fact, there's always been a legend that Jean Lafitte's treasure might be buried in the Devil's Punch Bowl, which is one of the titles of one of my books. Now, if I really believe that, I'd be down there myself.
They were some scurrilous men, the Pirates of the Mississippi.
There, and especially the outlaws of the Natchez Trace, you know, going up to Nashville. And I'm headed to Nashville two cities from now. We're looking at, in fact, the mayor and I and a couple people, we're working with Nashville to become sister cities because we're both at opposite ends of the Trace, 444 miles. But I tell you what, you took your life in your hands when you walked on that road.
I heard there's some supernatural stuff supposed to be on the
trails,
too.
Supposed to be, but I wouldn't be worried about the supernatural. There were outlaws famous for cutting the heads off their victims. That's what I'd be worried about.
So when would that noir might be seeing the light of day?
Oh, it'll be a year, maybe a little less than a year, I would think.
Well, Greg, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by and sharing this epic with us.
Thank you, Stephen. It's always fun.
Greg Isles is the author of Mississippi Blood, the final installment of the Natchez Burning Trilogy, and it's available from William Morrow. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.